There was a fire at a plant that produced just the dash for the Ford F-150. Just the dash, and it was a fire. And it single-handedly dragged U.S. industrial production lower, right? Just that one fire in the one plant for the one car. So the way I think about that is, again, I really like looking for echoes in the data of signals that we're trying to see. That supply chain disruption was so meaningful for one car in one plant for one part. Imagine what we're about to witness in terms of the disruption, in terms of higher prices for inputs for many of these vehicles. Again, I think an F-150 passes the border, across the border six or seven times when it's being produced in Canada or in Mexico. It doesn't automatically, you don't just flick the switch and produce that in the US. So this is a disruption that is going to be quite significant.
Welcome back. This is Inside is Capital. I'm your host, Pierre Daly. Joining me today is Ilan Colette, Institutional Portfolio Manager and member of Fidelity's Global Asset Allocation Team. And today, we're discussing his team's actionable outlook and the way forward for investors on the eve of April 2nd, when the Trump White House is expected to announce its intentions for trade and tariffs for Canada, Mexico, and the rest of the globe.
This is the Insight is Capital podcast.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast are those of the individual guests and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of AdvisorAnalyst.com or of our guests. This broadcast is meant to be for informational purposes only. Nothing discussed in this broadcast is intended to be considered as advice.
Ilan, great to have you on at this critical moment. Your most recent report goes into great detail about your team's views, appropriately titled Elbows Up. How are things shaping up?
Yeah, so Pierre, it's really great to be here. I always enjoy these conversations. They're always really wide-ranging. And you're absolutely right. We are on...
Yeah, so Ilan, I'm sorry. It is great to have you on again.
Yeah, I don't know.
I'm just jumping into things, but absolutely love having you on the show.
Yeah.
And especially as a regular, I think, you know, we pick up where we left off the last time. But so let's continue.
Sure.
How are things shaping up? It's pretty dicey time. It feels like a pretty critical moment, especially, you know, with this April 2nd deadline looming.
So that's absolutely correct, Pierre. I mean, like, I think about the last time we spoke and how significant of a change the discussion we're going to have today will be, right? So the last time we spoke, I was talking about productivity expansion in the U.S. and really remarkable things that we were witnessing in the U.S., this U.S. exceptionalism story, right? I think we talked about 50% higher participation rates from disabled workers and record levels of female participation and, you know, a CapEx boom and productivity enhancements and really remarkable things, like a checklist for kind of a fantastic outcome, which goes a long way in explaining why, you know, balanced funds returned, including ours, 20% last year, right? So that's
right.
I mean, I'm very sympathetic to advisors whose clients now think an average year is 20% in a balanced fund. I mean, my thoughts and prayers to those folks who are having those conversations. Those aren't going to be easy, but that was...
Yeah,
that
absolutely. I mean, that recency bias of that is not necessarily going to end up being productive, especially when you have to, you know, talk to your clients about making some important changes to their portfolios.
I mean, absolutely. So, and I had a conversation with an advisor earlier this year who said, you know, he sat down with his client and said, if I were to tell you last year that you earned 10%, what would you think? And they would say, great. And he said, well, you made 20%, right? And so, again, the recency bias is true. And the other thing that's happening right now, and we're seeing the evidence of this, and we're going to continue to see this, is a really significant change to that sort of underlying thesis that we outlined sort of at the end of last year and throughout last year and really in the start of this year. And that's resulted in a pretty significant change in positioning for us. And, you know, I know we're going to get into the details, but what we put forth in Elbows Up, and honestly, I can't believe Elbows Up got through compliance, but I mean, I'm glad it did so that we could title it that, which is an appropriate phrase. is the underpinnings of U.S. exceptionalism, you know, this like stable and predictable policy and sort of rule of law and the global sort of trading order and global trade. A lot of these things have come under threat. It's something that we point to in the paper, right? We have a really nice chart showing a measure of globalization and the peaking of it and that retreat. And while that has always been sort of a philosophical discussion, right? This end of globalism and peak globalism, peak globalization. It's sort of one of these TED Talk type topics that people talk about on fancy stages. I think now we are actually seeing, the result of this pullback in a global order and a global system that's lasted, that's been around since sort of the post-war period. And for us, what that means is, you know, these portfolios, we've talked about this in the past, they are tactical, right? We have tactical flexibility in these portfolios, right? So our 60-40 can be a 70-30 or it can be a 50-50.
Right.
And within that, we are changing where the equity allocations are overweight, right? So in short, the optimism and the lean into the U.S. has been removed. And we are now leaning in and more optimistic and giving more capital to the security selectors managing the underlying Europe sleeve, the EFI sleeve of these funds. And then the other thing that we've done is, and I hate to use the word, but I mean, this, what we're witnessing right now really smells a lot like stagflation. And we've added to inflation protection. And what we mean by that is we've added to gold and we've added to tips on the fixed income side. So stagflation is a word I don't take lightly. I don't, you know, we don't just throw that word around. But it is a word that is in this paper. And it reflects the meaningful change in positioning to protect our end investors against what we view as a pretty significant change.
Yeah, I think one of the weird things that's happening, which only happens every so often, like 98, 2003, 2008, is the simultaneous decline in the S&P 500 and the US dollar very recently. And I think that's, you know, maybe that's in anticipation of what's possibly coming this week. But, you know, when you see that, that's a terrible signal.
Yeah, I think you're spot on, Pierre. I mean, we're seeing things, you know, as investors, as economists, like you're never going to have full statistical confirmation. You're never going to have that perfectly checklist of what you're looking for, right? So we're always sort of looking for echoes in the data of a thesis, right? And you'll never have that sort of full confirmation like you would in like a math class type of thing. So, you know, when we set up this paper, the first couple of charts speak to this exceptionalism story. And then the third chart really sort of turns it on its head, right? So that first chart is the value of the US dollar. Again, exceptional levels. The second chart that we look at are, you know, the 12-month forward PE ratios for the US and then for Europe, right? For the MSCI ex-US, right? So, you know, basically the US and the rest of the world. And again, this exceptionalism story has, I think, sort of been fully priced in. And now we are seeing threats to that.
You had a great quote. The market has been priced, this is from your paper, from Elbows Up. The market has been priced for maximum U.S. exceptionalism, just as the U.S. government is undermining many of the things that made the U.S. exceptional. I thought that summed up so much of you know, the sentiment that's, you know, maybe undefined, but it's out there, is that people are saying, you know, what is going on? Why are they doing this? And you know, there seems to be a lot of policy gymnastics going on, like to try and make a whole bunch of conditions, you know, converge into this one outcome, like a parlay bet,
right?
On March Madness, you know, like the odds of succeeding are you know, appear to be, you know, close to nil.
Well, yeah, exactly, Pierre. I mean, So, you know, one of the names for this for the paper that had sort of been floated around, which I liked, but I think we would have lost folks, was just huh, like H-U-H question mark, right? So now, like, you know, I sort of like that sarcastic humor, but yeah. We, you know, again, maybe investors who read this may not have gotten that joke, but it really is a head scratcher, right? So again, if I rewind to that previous conversation we had, this U.S. exceptionalism story I thought was largely indestructible. Okay, so we have to be cognizant of very, very of stretched valuations. There's no question about that. But, you know, if I rewind to 6-9 months ago, the underpinnings of that exceptionalism were not just, it wasn't just a sugar high from like a lot of fiscal spending. I mean, there was fiscal spending, but it wasn't the only, this wasn't a sugar high, right? There were meaningful signals showing a higher level of potential growth in the US and a productivity surge. And a lot of that now is really coming under threat, right? And this is showing up, honestly, this is showing up in US surveys already, right? So we had some, it's showing up in the soft data. It has yet to show up in the hard data. And what I mean by that is soft data, surveys, hard data, employment, growth, consumer spending, auto sales, stuff like that. Now, it has shown up in the soft data, right? So the consumer confidence numbers that came out recently showed, you know, worry. Like there's a great Yiddish word, spilkes, right? It means underlying in internal sense of unease. And that's what's showing up in those, in that soft data. And then if we flip it to Canada, I mean, this is a whole different story, right? So, I mean, I'm sure we'll get into the discussion around tariffs in Canada, and there's a lot to unpack there, but I mean, the Bank of Canada's last interest rate announcement where they cut by 25 basis points, which they wouldn't have cut by 25 basis points had it not been for this tariff risk. They also released the results of a household and business survey that were really, really instructive, right? And we can certainly get into that stuff as well.
Yeah. So you mentioned the valuation gap. S&P 500 trades 22 times forward earnings versus 14 times for MSCI ex-US. What are you making of that? You say there's an erosion of US institutional strength.
Yeah, so I mean, it's interesting. So, you know, we have a four-pillar research process. Again, we've talked about this in the past. It's macro, bottom-up, sentiment, and valuation. The macro is the starting point for every discussion we have on the team between myself, David Tulk, and David Wolf. That's the background that we all come from with, you know, 20 plus years of combined experience from the Bank of Canada. The next place we go to is the bottom-up discussion. That's us speaking to the underlying managers and analysts that we use about what's actually happening on the ground with companies, right? And so, and valuation is the third one. So valuation, I mean, I think we can probably all agree, valuation is not an effective timing tool, right? So I'm sure you speak to a lot, if you speak to a lot of sort of underlying stock pickers, equity managers, they all have different views on valuation. Oh, it's incredibly important, or it's completely useless and I ignore it. The way that we view it is it's an important signal for us to be considering and thinking about, but it's not necessarily an effective timing tool. I mean, how long have I been talking about attractive valuations in emerging markets? Like I'm about to call out myself, right? So valuations have been attractive in emerging markets for ages, right? And emerging markets haven't really been the asset class that we've all hoped for. You know, I've joked, Pierre, that we've been waiting a long time for emerging markets to emerge, right? So, I mean, again, the valuations are attractive, but valuations by themselves are probably not an effective timing tool. But the way that we think about things is valuations need a catalyst, right? And the catalyst here on the negative side is what we're observing right now in the US, right? This undermining of institutions and political uncertainty. Right. And then separately, the valuations on the Europe side, I think, are showing something quite interesting. So again, valuations in Europe, they've also been attractive forever. And I'm sure, you know, probably in our last conversation, you know, one of the things I've said sometimes with clients is, you know, Europe is a wonderful place to visit and a terrible place to invest, right? And I love Europe and I love going to Europe, but
yeah,
had you allocated to Europe instead of the US over the last 10, 15 years, I mean, you'd be poorer today, right? And so, and that's sort of been the view. Now, with the valuations are attractive again in Europe. And then again, we need to think about that second point, which is the catalyst. And so What is the catalyst in Europe? I'm not sure we can pinpoint to any specific sort of moment or thing, but something is happening in Europe right now where, you know,
that one sort of big item that seems to be getting a lot of press is the debt break in Germany.
Exactly. Right. So the debt break in Germany. Right. So again, this speaks to trying to find, you know, signals in the echoes of the data, right? So we're never going to have a checkbox that says it, but the debt break is one, right?
And that's like the unintended consequence of all this policy uncertainty, right? The U.S. seems to have abandoned any sort of, confirmed support.
Well, exactly.
Of what's happening in, you know, of Europe, of the, you know, the support for the war effort against Russia and Ukraine. I mean, all of that has sort of unfolded in the last couple of, I mean, it's hard to believe. Like, I feel like, you know, the last time we spoke feels like it was a year ago.
No, exactly.
So much has happened and including this debt break being lifted in Germany.
Well, and none of us, I don't think any of us could have really predicted with the outcome of the election that we would be seeing today what we're seeing now, right? So I wouldn't have predicted, you know, that interaction in the Oval Office. I wouldn't have predicted, the Vance speech at that European security conference. I wouldn't have predicted the debt break or the significant, basically hockey stick type movement in proposed German defense spending, right? So again, these are all sort of circuit breakers in terms of getting the echoes of the data or the signals for us to be thinking about, has a catalyst actually entered Europe? And if that's the case, we know the valuations are attractive. Could this lead to sort of excess performance for some of our stock pickers in Europe? And the answer for us is we think so, right? And so what we've done is that optimism in the US that we talked probably three times about last year has now sort of been neutralized, and we've given more capital to those security selectors in Europe for them to you know, pick the names and pick the companies that can boost the performance of our fund, right? So I would say the interesting thing here is we're still optimistic. I mean, we're still slightly overweight equities in our funds. It's smaller than it was in the past because of the uncertainty, but it's that optimism is now leaning into a completely different geographic area than it was 6 or 9 months ago.
Yeah. So now because of the White House's attack on U.S. exceptionalism, you have reduced exposure to the U.S.
I mean, so a large chunk of the fund is still going to be U.S. equities.
Of course.
You know, and that's a baseline allocation, but exactly. So our job, again, that 60-40 can be 70-30, can be 50-50. And within those plus or minus sort of 10 or 15%, we can move geographically across styles and sectors. And right now, the big change is, you know, we're leaning into Europe. Because of this catalyst. And again, the other big thing to think about is, of course, the effect on Canada. I mean, there's a large Canadian content in a lot of our funds, and we've been cautious on Canada for some time. I mean, our story for a long time really predates me, actually, even on the team, is Canadians are over their skis on debt, and that debt is intersecting rates that's going to be higher than when that debt originated, and there's going to be a pullback in consumer spending as Canadians pay their principal mortgage. All of that stuff has already happened. And rates are now moving lower, but the new front and center risk are tariffs. It'll take a few minutes for me to unpack, but I think talking about tariffs is critical. And the way, Pierre, I've always sort of the way I've been talking about tariffs is
in the scope of four buckets, if we have a few minutes, I can kind of
By all means, please do.
So, you know, because it's an absolutely critical discussion for us to have. I'll caffeine up here. So, you know, before talking about what are the effect of tariffs on the Canadian economy, right? That's the question that everyone wants to know. I've started the discussion by saying, well, why don't I rewind 20 years to sitting at the Bank of Canada, right? I was sitting in an office next to David Tulk, who's now a good colleague of mine, and David Wolf was advisor to Carney, to Governor Carney at the time.
Right.
You know, if we got the question from the governor at the time, we're about to be 25% tariffs are about to be imposed on us, on everything that we export. What's the effect on the Canadian economy? And before answering that question, I mean, there's three assumptions we'd need to make, right? So before typing anything on the keyboard into those, you know, econometric models that take into account retaliatory tariffs and consumption effects and fiscal effects, right? These are full blown models, as they say. There's three questions you'd have to ask. How big are the tariffs, right? Is it 25% or is it zero and they kick the can a month? Or is it 50% because of retaliatory on retaliatory, right? Or is it 10% for only a few sectors, right? So it's been all of those things. So if the first question is how big, the second question is, what's the list of items that are going to face these tariffs, right? Is it every single thing that we export, or is it one or two line items, right? So for example, like 95% of the frozen French fries consumed in the U.S. are imported from Canada. There's a fact,
a big one,
a fact you didn't know you needed, or any of your viewers.
That's a really big one.
Right. So if it's that one line item, Canada will be fine. I mean, I'm not, PEI might be hit hard, but Canada will be fine. If it's everything, it's a different story. So the first question is how big? The second question is what's the list? And the third question is how long do these tariffs last, right? Is it a day, a week, a month? Is this a new steady state and it's permanent? And the most honest answer to those three questions, regardless of the ink spilled, and the experts that we see on TV is, I don't know, I don't know, and I don't know, right?
Yeah.
That's the most honest answer. Now, that's a useless answer, so let me provide a bit more context. Like, you'd have to make assumptions on all three of those things. The second thing I think for us to talk about is...
Yeah, so you know, it reminds me of, you know, when you watch, you know, when they're talking about hurricanes, and you see that cone of possibilities...
Exactly.
And show that, you know, the path of the hurricane, and the path of the hurricane is right through the middle of that, you know, that curve of that distribution curve that they always show.
Exactly. You know, I mean, that's
the same thing here. There's so many possibilities and combinations that, you know, you kind of have to, you almost in this case, because there's so many variables that, you know, the outcome could be anything right now without knowing what actually is going to happen. Yeah.
I mean, exactly right. So, you know, the second thing I like to talk about sometimes when we talk about tariffs is, let's put some numbers around the trading relationship, right? Just because let's set up some guardrails in terms of what we're talking about. And at a high level, 30% of Canadian GDP is exports, okay? 75 to 80% of those exports go to one customer, the US. So 20% of Canadian GDP, roughly, are just exports to the US, right? That's huge, right? I mean, for Mexico, it's like 26, 27%, but for Canada, it's 20% of our GDP. Now, to put that in perspective, housing is like 9 to 10%, right? So it's trade to the U.S. is enormous, a big driver of growth. And the big buckets, I think we all know, are commodities, oil, cars, then some consumer stuff, consumer products. On the U.S., if you ask me, Pierre, well, what's the contribution of trade to Canada to the U.S. economy, it would be impossible to see the line on the chart, right? It's de minimis, but that actually overlooks important linkages. And for me, the one that really comes to mind is oil. And the way to think about that is the U.S. consumes roughly 20 million barrels a day of oil. 40% of that oil is imported, and 60% of those imports come from Canada, meaning, I don't know, 15%-ish.
Right.
Of oil, of U.S. domestic oil consumption is imported Canadian oil. Now, I'm not an oil engineer. I don't know. I really don't know how it comes out of the ground. But I know that if you make it more difficult, you don't just turn the dial in the U.S. to the right and get more coming out of the ground. Right. So it's not that easy. So that's the second question. The third question, though, is what is the impact of a 25% tariff on the Canadian economy? And the reason at the very beginning I highlighted what would I have done at the Bank of Canada if I was still sitting there is because the Bank of Canada did this analysis. So they did it first in the first Trump presidency in April 2019 on page 24 of the PDF in their monetary policy report. And then they updated it and they sort of redid it in January of this year in the monetary policy report. And there are four numbers for folks to remember as the key takeaway, right? And I'm kind of combining that 2019 and this year's analysis. A 25% tariff results in a 4-6% decline in GDP in Canada over 2 years. That's large, right? That's bigger than the decline in GDP in the financial crisis or in the 90 recession or in the 80s recession. That's probably 800,000 to a million jobs, right? So this is a very significant recession. So 25% tariff, 4-6% decline in GDP, 3% upward shock to the rate of inflation, not the shock we need after prices are up 20 or 25% from COVID. And then the fourth one is a 17 to 25% depreciation of the Canadian dollar from where we are now. That puts the Canadian dollar in the 52 to 57 cent range, right? So the way to think about this is the shock is big, is really, really big and really significant. And then the last thing to know.
Even if it's half of what you just described.
Exactly. Even if it's half of what I described. Now, the last thing to note here, and then I promise I'll stop talking at you about this
I'm all ears. I love it.
The last thing to talk about is, you know, I always like to end it with what are we doing and what are we not doing, right? So what are we doing? We talked about a little bit of this. We've pivoted away geographically from the U.S. into Europe, where we think there's more opportunity. We've added to inflation protection in the form of gold and tips on the fixed income side.
I think those two moves were, reading your reading elbows up, those two moves were the real standout moves.
Absolutely. That's the intended goal of that paper. Those were the major changes. The other thing that we've done is, you know, we have a pretty meaningful underweight to the Canadian dollar, right? In the presence of a Canadian dollar depreciation, if we're underweight the Canadian dollar, our funds get hurt less. We preserve basis points. And this underweight to the Canadian dollar, this was instituted, you know, at the end of last year, right? So this predates the real ramp up in rhetoric. That's what we're doing. That's what we've done. What are we not doing, which I think is equally as important, is we're not overreacting to every headline. We're not repositioning these funds every day or every week, right? We're not being reactionary to every gyration or tweet that might come out, because the way that we've achieved the results in these funds at the 1, 3, 5, 7, and 10 year horizon is with a very deliberate and incremental research-based process, right, for asset allocation, right? So that's what our investors are expecting. They're not expecting us to sort of game tariffs on a weekly basis.
Yeah, I mean, I look at what you're doing and you know, the transparency of what you're doing, the regular reporting, the lengths you go to describe the conditions that led to those decisions. Aside from the obvious of allocating funds to your global allocation strategy, global asset allocation strategies, I think it serves as a really useful roadmap for advisors, for investors to think about, make comparative assessments of, how's my portfolio positioned versus something that has a more institutional tilt. To me, the most notable moves were the addition of gold or the increase in allocations to gold and tips.
There's a couple of points in there to just expand on. So again, our goal in these
and the dollar too, by the way. Yeah, sorry.
Right. Right. I mean, so our goal in these papers is we want them to be short and clear and not just digestible by advisors, but investors should understand as well what we're trying to do, right? So that's the goal, because, we've talked about this a lot in the past, Pierre, but I think our industry is just overrun with jargon and like unnecessarily complex schematics. I don't know, maybe it makes us feel smarter. But I think if we can explain things in English to the stakeholders of our funds, right? There's more than 600,000 investors alone in, you know, in the managed portfolios, right? So we want my goal is I want every single one of those readers to understand completely what we're doing, whether it be through the paper or discussions like this, right? Because there is a tremendous amount of research, you know, underlying managers and research process that goes into the management of these funds. But as we've talked about in the past, they're kind of elegant solutions to really complex problems, right? That's the first thing. The other thing that you mentioned, Pierre, that's absolutely worth discussing is, I mean, it's fascinating to me. So one of the research providers that we use did a survey of American consumers on tariffs, and a staggering number of the respondents think that tariffs get paid by us. So like they don't, there's this sort of disconnect between who pays the tariff. Now let's not pretend that it isn't a tax, right? It is a tax. And, you know, I'm a board member for the National Association for Business Economics. I've been a member for, you know, more than 20 years. And, you know, there are business economists that make up the board, and, you know, in discussions with them, it's really, really insightful because there, you know, if, let me rewind during the Trump's first presidency, when there was a 20% tariff levied on imported washing machines, right? So this is a fascinating test case. There's two interesting test cases from Trump 1.0 that are worth discussing. The first is a 20% tariff on imported washing machines, right? So I was the head of inflation and commodities research down in Boston on our asset allocation research team at the time. And so every month I would get, you know, the CPI and the PCE data and look at prices. And underneath that report, you get 356 lines of detail for the price for everything, right? And it's chopped up into goods and services. And under goods, you have durable goods. And under durable goods, you have major household appliances. And under major household appliances, you have a line item called washing and drying machines.
Right. Okay.
That's actually what the line item is called. Yeah. Right? They're not called washers and dryers. They're called washing and drying machines. That category was inflating at a steady rate. Tariffs were imposed. And in the 2 months following the tariff, that line jumped by 19.9%, meaning they were not passed on dollar for dollar. They were passed on penny for penny. And the domestic, there are a small amount of washers that are produced domestically. Those guys came along for the ride and jacked prices by 20%. And what do you buy when you buy a washing machine? You also buy a dryer. The tariff wasn't on dryers. The dryers went up 20% as well, right? So because...
There was this great visual from Visual Capitalist or Voronoi, and it was a map of the U.S. with all the states and who their biggest trading partner was.
Yep.
And all of the many red states are bordering on Canada and around the Great Lakes. And the thing that was surprising was, and then if you look, so those were Canada's biggest trading partners, you know, I mean, Illinois among the top because of oil. But then if you looked at California, it was China. If you looked at Florida, surprisingly, it was China. Hmm. And if you looked at the central and south Midwest, it was Mexico.
Right.
So if you looked at this map and the East Coast was a combination of Canada and China. And if you looked at, you know, coming back to this, you know, this exact discussion, that we're having about what a tariff does to the price of goods. You know, I think a lot of red state Republican voters are in for, you know, ironically, the surprise is, hey, you're gonna foot the bill.
Well, I mean, this is it. And so,
you know,
and there's no way, I don't know how you avoid job loss, right? So job loss has many implications, obviously. It's a massive damage, you know, to societal fabric. It's jarring for families. It's a traumatic event, right? That shouldn't be taken lightly. I mean, And I don't.
A lot of folks in those states have already suffered. You know, exactly. For example, like Pennsylvania, the Rust Belt.
Yeah,
they already suffered. You know, historically massive downturns.
Well, I mean, that's it. So, and this motivation of, you know, the of a manufacturing renaissance coming back to the U.S. Is just, I think, misguided. I mean, I don't know if you've seen the chart of the share of jobs in the U.S. in manufacturing, right? It looks, it's a ski slope, essentially. It's high in the 50s, and it's a straight line down, and then it flattens out to kind of a low level, like, you know, sub 10%, right? I mean, so I think this idea of a manufacturing renaissance is misguided. Now, if you have to produce goods domestically, that changes the inflation picture completely, right? So Wall Street Journal had a really good article on the weekend about this. I mean, the way to think about this, this was one of the first charts I showed when I started at Fidelity in 2014. All of the inflation in the US, all of it, since the mid to late 90s, has come from the service sector, right? So if I had to draw inflation charts in the air on our discussion right now, I mean, inflation is a line moving higher. Services look like this, but right. Since the 90s, goods look like that, right? So goods since the mid to late 90s are a flat line. And then in COVID, you see a step change, and then it's now moving sideways. Now, right. Why did that happen? It's because of an explosion in globalization and imports, right? Where you could, you know, every single time you went to the Gap, the jeans got cheaper, right? And if you went to the back of the Gap, you could buy jeans for like $2, right? So, so who benefited from this? It's the U.S. consumer, right? And the U.S. consumer, again, third largest economy in the world, just the consumer. And the U.S. consumer benefited tremendously from this influx of cheaper and cheaper imports, at the same time hollowing out the manufacturing sector. Yeah. And, you know, and a lot of the U.S., right? So,
but in many cases, the everyday consumer was once also the everyday laborer.
Exactly. That's exactly right.
And with the change in the makeup of the U.S. economy from manufacturing in being in a steady decline for several decades and services being in a steady incline for several decades, how do you reconcile that? How do you reconcile that, you know, like, yeah, we enjoyed a flurry of, you know, cheap goods for several decades because everything was being made abroad, but, you know, by cheaper labor and, you know, we sacrificed our manufacturing sector in favor of, you know, deflated prices for all goods.
Right. But, and this, I mean, again, this is a really, really difficult question. This is one to speak to, you know, a labor economist about. You know, there's really, really excellent work by Alan Krueger, who's since passed away, unfortunately. But Alan Krueger is an economist who pioneered research on this. Right, it had a lot to do with all sorts of negative societal outcomes, right? Deaths of despair, opiate addiction, right? Hollowing out of certain areas. Angus Deaton as well, right? He won the Nobel Prize for this. These are fascinating streams of research, but this idea that you're going, I mean, the hollowing out of manufacturing and importing cheap goods so that the U.S. consumer could buy everything all the time, these went hand in hand, right? So as you discussed. Now, on that 20% tariff that I mentioned, right? So the 20% tariff was imposed by Trump on imported washing machines.
Right.
It happened to dryers as well. And the line item went up 19.9%, right? And so it was passed on to the consumer dollar for dollar, penny for penny. The other shock that happened that really was buried in the data and would go largely unnoticed was when I was living in Boston and covering inflation, there was a fire at a plant that produced just the dash for the Ford F-150, right?
Right, right.
It was just the dash and it was a fire and it single-handedly dragged U.S. industrial production lower, right? Just that one fire in the one plant for the one car, right? So the way I think about that is, again, I really like looking for echoes in the data of signals that we're trying to see. That, you know, that supply chain disruption was so meaningful for one car in one plant for one part. Imagine what we're about to witness in terms of the disruption in terms of higher prices for inputs, right, for many of these vehicles. Again, I think an F-150 passes the border, across the border six or seven times when it's being produced. You know, you don't, if a chunk of that car is produced in Canada, it doesn't, or in Mexico, it doesn't automatically, you don't just flick the switch and produce that in the US, right? So this is a disruption that that is going to be quite significant.
Right.
And we're positioned accordingly.
Well, you know, I wanted to say just on a personal front, I have a GMC truck, and I had a collision last year. Somebody drove into my passenger side in a lane change, in a bad lane change. And when I was in between the time I filed my claim to when my body shop could take my vehicle and repair it, it took 6 or 7 weeks for them to get the part, the door panels, both door panels on the passenger side from the US.
Right.
Right? Because these things are made, they're made on demand. They're not stockpiling door panels in some warehouse somewhere.
Right.
And they can just, they once did, I think maybe far in the past, you needed a part for replacement. You could get it almost right away. But with the way things have changed in the auto industry, the auto parts manufacturing, my friends were like, when is your vehicle going into the body shop? Didn't you just file a claim for that? Because we're here sitting here at 7 weeks. Here we are. It was October was the accident. And January was when they took my vehicle to fix it, right? So, so I drove around with this dented right, passenger side of my vehicle for what seemed like an eternity, waiting for those panels to come in. But
right.
But to me, when I think about that, I think, why did it take so long? These parts get damaged all the time. People drive into people have collisions all the time. Are they all waiting 7 weeks for the door panels to come? And so to me that signaled a change in the supply chain already, which is
I think you're right, massive delays. And I think this has been consistent throughout the auto sector, right? So it used to be, this reminds me, well, first I'm glad everyone was fine in the accident, but
nobody got hurt. It was just a stupid collision, but I'm just, I don't remember it taking so long to get auto parts for collision repair.
Yeah. So, Pierre, it's interesting. One of the discussions I've had with, again, some of these colleagues of mine on this National Association for Business Economics who work in various parts of the business sector, specifically the auto industry, is that just in time has become more and more just in time. Right. So a lot of us have now become even adjusted to, gone are the days when you go walk the lot and say, oh, I'll have that one, right? You build your car on your computer or your phone or your iPad, and then you see where that's available, right? So more and more, one of the things that has happened, I think, in the auto industry post-COVID is people are just much more comfortable sort of taking the kind of Apple store approach, to buying and building a car.
Right.
Which means even more of a just-in-time type of move. But what that, exactly as you highlighted, what that makes us susceptible to are supply chain issues, right? And again, I think how this trade disruption bubbles through the automotive
sector. What's going to happen?
And exactly. Many other sectors. I mean, and again, what did we learn? What did we learn recently when parts, when goods are in short supply, what happens to them, right? The prices go up, right?
Right.
Right. So now there's lots of differences between what we're observing now and the COVID shock, but if there's a healthy amount of demand and there's fewer items, the price goes up, right? And so that, again, pains me to say we're in stagflation, but there is a flavor of stagflation in the positioning of our funds right now.
So now, in the context of this tariff risk, this tariff uncertainty that we've got, that we're facing this week, and possibly on an ongoing basis, on again, off again, you have maintained your underweight position on Canada.
We are cautious on Canada. Again, the main motivation for that was this longstanding concern of elevated debt, elevated household debt, higher rates. And for a while, and we talk about this in the paper, for a while we thought, you know, we pulled in that underweight, so not as defensive around Canadian equities as we would have been. We pulled it in because we thought, you know, maybe Canada is sort of the best house in the worst neighborhood, right? Facing these tariffs. But as we discussed in the paper, it seems we're actually closer to that sketchy park that we don't want to be next to. Again, yeah, we might be compiling metaphors here. But the issue is, you know, we've looked at the data, we've spoken to the researchers, and the caution around Canada in the presence of tariffs is significant. Now, a couple of important clarifications. Oftentimes when I talk about Canada, people think, and our cautious view, that we don't own any Canadian equities or that we're cheering for some.
Right. No, I mean, you know, you have a...
And that's not the case, right?
So, yeah.
Exactly. So 21% of our 60-40 fund are Canadian equities. We're just trimming that a little bit and allocating it into other buckets that we think will outperform. Last year it was the US, and now it's more overseas. And again, we have a tremendous stack of underlying managers, building block managers that we use in these funds on the Canadian side, you know, who have done very, very well over the long term. And if they do well, they boost the performance of our fund. So again,
just to sum up a little bit of the past discussion, you've reduced your holding with your US stock pickers.
That's right.
You've increased your holdings with your stock pickers globally, Europe.
Yep.
And you've maintained, reduced at all? It's
roughly been maintained as a modest underweight to Canada.
Right.
And again, this.
You're maintaining position and adjusting your attitude towards the US and Europe.
Exactly.
Negatively reducing US, increasing Europe and globally, and maintaining the same position in Canada. It's not an all or nothing. These aren't all or nothing trades.
No, yeah. Exactly. Again, yeah. I mean, what we're trying to do is incrementally shift these funds, given the process, given the research, you know, to add one basis point to the mountain, one basis point at a time, right? So the philosophy underpinning these funds is the long-term investor, and that's why we always move incrementally and deliberately. I mean, we don't want to overreact, but at the same time we don't want to underreact, right? So
right.
I mean, that's the goal of these funds being tactical, and that's what we'll continue to do.
Well, things might change negatively this week, in which case you've taken a more defensive posture. But 2 months from now, there could be a complete reversal with some agreement on something.
And this is it. I mean, this is right.
I mean, so you can't anticipate that because, you know, a lot of this stuff is happening, you know, as a result of you know, a Sharpie hitting a piece of paper.
Well, exactly. I mean, the best example of that, Pierre, is, you know, I had the pleasure of snowboarding at Revelstoke about a month ago.
Nice.
And the news on tariffs when I was getting on the gondola was different than when I got to the top of that gondola, right? So I was checking my phone at the bottom, then I get to the top and the news would be different at the top. And then by the time I got to the bottom, which at Revelstoke takes a really long time, it'd be completely different. Yeah. But, you know, the funds are not reacting to every little blip and every little swipe of the Sharpie or tweet. The way that we want to manage these funds is, again, for the long-term investor to build wealth, you know, one basis point at a time over the benchmark over the long term.
I wanted to just circle back to the defensive assets. You know, what is your position on, what kind of position have you taken in gold and in TIPS?
What weightings
do they represent?
Yeah, so, I mean, these are... they're not huge allocations, right? So the way to think about our position around the commodity sector is most of it's gold. I mean, and when I say they're small, it's about 2% of a 60-40 stock bond fund, the Global Fidelity Global Balanced Managed Portfolio. About 2% is gold. And then there's a little bit in oil and a little bit in Global Natural Resources, another underlying Fidelity fund. The 2% that's in gold is to an ETF, right? So because what we're trying to achieve is exposure to the price of gold and not necessarily the miners, right? And,
right,
underlying equities. That said, you know, it's interesting. Last week, I actually asked one of the analysts that I work with on a look-through basis, meaning if you look through to all the underlying managers and what those underlying managers are holding, and you cast the widest net on anything gold, what's the allocation to gold? And it's closer to 4%. And the reason for that is it's a 2% overweight to the ETF. But then those underlying managers that we own, you know, in the US and in Canada can own certain stocks that may that may be gold miners, right? And so that gets it to around 4%. On the inflation protection side, on the fixed income side of the portfolio, that's TIPS. Again, these are fixed income asset classes that price to monthly non-seasonally adjusted CPI. That's not a huge allocation as well. That's, you know, in that 2% range. It's not a significant overweight, but the way that we think about inflation protection is buying insurance against the damaging effects of inflation, right? And so the last chart in the paper is, it's a really nice chart. It's I love all my charts equally, but this one is also nice. But is the inflation adjusted price of gold going back to, you know, the mid 60s, and it's inflation adjusted such that the most recent price is the price you're looking at, right? Just to put it into context. And sure enough, I mean, we know what gold did last year. We know what gold did in 2022. And that's the reason, that's that motivation for gold being a reliable hedge against the damaging effects of inflation. It is a question that comes up a lot. Oh, should I liquidate my portfolio and just buy gold? Well, okay, hang on a second. I mean, there are entire chunks of history where gold dramatically underperforms a well-balanced portfolio, but gold serves the purpose of being an effective inflation hedge. We can't be dismissive of what we're observing right now, right? I mean, that wouldn't be the right approach, because there are too many circuit breakers being tripped in terms of, you know, that internal sense of unease. Again, you don't want to overreact, but at the same time, you don't want to underreact either.
Yeah, the best portfolio that investors can hope to own is the one that they continue to own.
Exactly. Right. Yeah.
Wonderful conversation. Thank you so much. I you know, you always bring such a great amount of clarity to these discussions, and you're eloquent in the delivery of that. I think that's very important, because it's a really confusing period. I think anybody listening to this is going to get a lot out of this, as they might have in our past conversations. Can't wait to get you back on for the next update.
Thanks, Pierre. I always enjoy these conversations. Those are really kind words. My head's not going to fit through the door after this after this discussion. But I'd welcome a chat anytime, as you know.
Love it, Elon. Thank you so much.
Thanks.